Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 25, 2005. This is Doug Henwin, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I'm back here in person after 2 weeks wandering off on vacation travels up in Quebec, visiting Montreal, Quebec City, some stops in Vermont and Maine and Massachusetts, and avoided all that heat that I understand was afflicting the city last week. A good time to take a northern trip. And Quebec, really nice place to be. But here I am back, and I've got two guests on tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll speak with Seth Kleinman, who is a markets analyst with PFC Energy, an oil talking about the oil market, what's going on with why oil prices are in the high 60s. We had him on about a year ago when oil was considerably lower, talking about what then seemed like very high oil prices. Well, they're even higher than they were then, and we'll ask him what's going on with that what might be going on in the future. And then at the bottom of the hour, a rerun of an interview I did with Jennifer Gordon in March of this year. I think it was broadcast on March 17th. Jennifer Gordon is a lawyer, a law professor at Fordham, founder of something called the Workplace Project, which tried to organize immigrant workers on Long Island. And we'll talk to her about that project and what that was all about that at the bottom of the hour. And just a few words in the economic headlines before we get to Seth Kleinman. We've got the usual, first of all, the ABC Washington Post Consumer Comfort Index, that weekly measure of consumer attitudes, falling 2 points in the week. It's been bouncing around at a sort of mediocre level. It's not high. It's not low. It's certainly not where you would expect it to be 3.5, almost 4 years into an economic expansion by any means. Still a lot of skepticism. Also other polls showing similar anxieties about the job market in particular, worries about high oil prices, high gasoline prices. And boy, driving around on vacation, I certainly I'm mostly shielded from that. Don't spend a lot of time driving, but rent a car. And the rental agency only had SUVs. So I was driving an SUV around for a couple of weeks, a source of embarrassment and also of great expense. Yeah, it certainly costs a lot. $45 to fill up a tank. It's quite a shock. And so a lot of people concerned about that. Jobless claims, the weekly tally of people who head over to the unemployment insurance office after losing their jobs, signing up for benefits. That was down by 4,000 last week, less than most analysts were expecting, and the previous week's numbers were revised higher by 3,000. So after taking a dive from peak around May, the unemployment claims indicator creeping a little higher. So it's certainly not portending that labor market is falling apart, but it's also, again, showing this expansion, such as it is, has shown a repeated failure of the labor market to thrive, and it's just a very strange thing. We should be seeing much more vigorous hiring than we have in this the last several years. It's one of the mysteries of this very strange economic expansion, which, despite large gobs of monetary and fiscal stimulus, very low interest rates until recently, and they're still pretty low by historical standards, although they're creeping higher thanks to the Federal Reserve tightening policy, very large budget deficits, big tax cuts, big spending increase on the military. Those things normally would be expected to kick an economy into high gear, but it's just not been happening. It's this is the weakest expansion as measured by GDP growth of any since the end of World War II. We've had 10 of these cycles. This the weakest in growth terms. So it's still really a subpar economic performance. And I believe a couple of polls, the American Research Group and the Harris Poll, both coming out with George Bush's approval ratings now at 40% or below, which pollsters consider the sign of an administration in serious trouble. And I think we'll have on our favorite pollster or cephologist analyst of polls, Rita Shera, on next week to talk about that. But the Bush administration, on the verge of looking like they're in serious political trouble, although they have been getting their way with just about everything. So trouble may be in the abstract sense, but we'll take on that issue next week. And the other day, the Commerce Department releasing its monthly read on durable goods orders. Durable goods are those things designed to last 3 years or more. They're purchased by both consumers and by businesses, but they're a measure of long-term economic growth, long-term economic confidence. Falling by 5% in the month of July, following just a 2% increase in June, weaker than expected, and not a good number. One of the things that analysts look at in this release is something called non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft. Aircraft orders bounce around from month to month, so you can't really rely on those very much. But what we're looking at is what businesses are buying machinery, the kinds of things that the kinds of investments that power economic expansions. That was off almost 4% in the month of July, and it's been quite weak over the last several months. It had a bounce in June after a sharp decline in May, but the June recovery was almost entirely reversed in July, so we're well below April's levels now. So this is, again, yet another sign of a not tremendously great economic expansion. Although the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly measures of a leading index, which is designed to forecast where the economy is going 6 months out or so, that now in a fairly steady uptrend. So maybe this patch of economic weakness is only a short thing. We'll see. Conflicting reads on the housing market, existing home sales, a measure produced by the National Association of Realtors, that was down in the month of July, prompting some people to think that maybe the air is coming out of the housing bubble a little bit. But then the Census Bureau's tally of new house sales was up strongly. For the month of July. Contradictory signals coming out of the housing market. But I think this one has been going for so long, it's going to take a lot to crack it. Some amazing statistics in the Wall Street Journal the other day, a story on the financing arrangements that have been keeping this housing bubble going. Almost a quarter of what are called subprime mortgages, that is for people with low incomes or bad credit ratings who are the riskiest people to lend to, almost a quarter of those are being done with very low interest-only payments. That is, people are not covering any of the principal. They're not retiring any of their debt. They're just covering the interest payments, if that, with a mortgage. That's up to 25% of the subprime mortgages. That was 0% in 2001. And about almost half of those, or actually slightly over half of those subprime loans now are coming without full data being disclosed to the lenders on the borrower's income and assets. So they're lending this money basically blind on the faith that somehow, somewhere, somebody's going to come up with this money to pay it. It's a remarkable adventure in finance that we've been experiencing in the housing market for the last couple of years. Let's take a little musical break, and then we'll be back with Seth Kleinman. From the Who's 1971 song, Going Mobile. I don't care about pollution. I'm an air-conditioned gypsy. That's the American dream. And now we're joined by Seth Kleinman, who is an oil analyst with PFC Energy based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Behind the News, Seth.
Hi there.
So I didn't follow what oil did today, but we were up at $67 yesterday.
Hit a new record high today. Hit 68 today.
Aha. So this is certainly not in inflation-adjusted terms yet matching the levels we saw around 1880, but we're getting up there.
Yes, we are.
So, first of all, what's your analysis of what is driving oil prices higher? How much is fundamentals? How much is speculative froth? What are the forces driving oil up close to $70?
There has been a lot of speculative money flowing into oil, particularly over the last month. It's not exactly clear what has triggered this, but there is no doubt there's been a whole lot of extra billions of dollars flowing into oil. But underpinning that is some very bullish fundamentals. And the thing is that they're fairly structural, and it's not really clear that there's an immediate remedy to them. What you really have is what's really come to the fore is the problem of the refinery bottleneck situation here in the U.S. You just don't have enough refineries to produce all the product that people want.
Why should the refinery situation affect crude prices, though?
Because without the refineries, product prices become expensive because there's an inadequate supply for the very strong demand. So product prices get more and more expensive, and that feeds through into crude. If I'm a refiner and I can sell a barrel of gasoline for $85, then I don't mind having to pay $65, $70 for a barrel of oil because I'm still making good money.
Okay, so and how many barrels of oil does it take to make a barrel of gas? Is it one for one, or how much is lost in the process of refining?
Well, actually, there's actually a bit that's gained in the process of refining. But in the U.S., the refineries are structured so that about 50% of crude oil is turned into gasoline.
Okay, then the rest becomes diesel and jet
25%
fuel.
25% diesel, and then the rest, jet fuel, naphtha, LPG, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh.
Okay, so what are the other fundamentals? How much is the Chinese demand and Indian demand figuring into this?
What I think is really of concern, what's so worrying purely from a U.S. perspective, is that last year what really got prices running up was this surge in global oil demand, particularly out of China, but also in the U.S. had amazingly strong demand last year, but it was really spread all around the world. What I think is of such a concern is that this year Chinese demand has actually been pretty weak. The growth has been much less than anyone expected for a variety of internal factors, and we've seen a lot comparatively weak growth in Asia because there's been this price effect. The governments haven't been able to maintain their subsidies, and products have got a lot more expensive, and we have seen weakening demand, but prices have kept marching up because of the strong demand here in the U.S. And so what that means is the only thing that is really going to derail this long-run upward trend in crude prices is a slowdown in demand in the U.S., which really has to mean a recession.
So are we really driving global oil demand growth right now?
The U.S. is driving prices higher, not really necessarily. This year's growth has been actually fairly standard. About a 1.9 million barrel a day growth rate is not exceptional. So the U.S. is playing its typical role as the prime consumer. But it's really more of the problem is really on products right now.
And the European economies keep showing signs of recovery, but they're always fizzling out on us. But Japan is now showing signs of some kind of pickup also. What would this do to the oil market if Japan actually started accelerating?
Well, Germany is another place that is showing some economic signs of life. Neither OECD, Asia, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, nor Europe really have much growth in terms of oil demand themselves. Both of them are very energy efficient. Europeans really focused on diesels for their cars. Their growth is pretty flat regardless of what happens with the economy, but there is this spillover effect, particularly in Japan. It's really a motor for the whole region economically. And so if it really does get going, then you would see spillover demand increases in Vietnam, Thailand, and other Asian countries.
Turning back to the refinery problem in the U.S., I think there were several refineries that went offline the last couple of weeks, fires, explosions, other kinds of problems. But the refinery capacity is very, very tight. Why is there such a lack of surplus refinery capacity?
Because if you look over the last 20 years, it's been a terrible business to be in. They've just been getting just made no money, and no one moved up inside an oil company by convincing anyone to invest in refineries. What you had to do was cost cutting, and it was this relentless cost cutting, paring back maintenance to its bare minimum, that has left the U.S. refineries old, out of shape, not very well maintained, hence the explosions. And now all of a sudden, there's no spare capacity anymore, because particularly because we had such an explosive growth in the U.S. for demand last year. So sudden we're at this crunch point, and that's what's really driving oil prices higher.
And does the industry not believe that prices are going to stay this high for very long? If they believe they're going to stay this high for very long, they might actually build some refineries, wouldn't they?
Well, it's not that easy to get a refinery built in this country. No one wants one built anywhere. I mean, over the last 10 years, we haven't built a refinery since 1976 in this country. The U.S. has been in this position for a long time, where demand, supply of in terms of a refinery capacity grows a little bit each year. Demand has been growing a lot, such that the U.S. has actually needed a decent-sized refinery to be built in another country every single year for the last 10 years. It'll cost you $200 million just to get the environmental permitting for a refinery, and you might not get that permitting. So these are very, very real, considerable sums of money, and there hasn't been much money in this sector so far. And I think oil companies are gradually realizing and are accepting that oil crude prices may stay high, but very few people in the industry believe that refinery margins are going to stay high. It's been a very much a boom and bust business.
And what about the supply side? Some people say that these high prices are actually a reflection of that we're coming close to a peak in global oil production. We may be soon heading down that peak to a long-term decline. How much of this is figuring into the price situation?
I think we're a fair way off from the peak of oil. What you have seen is demand has suddenly caught up with supply, but there's some really big slugs of supply coming on in the next couple of years out of the Caspian, out of West Africa. Once you get beyond that, once you're talking more of like a 2010, 2012 time frame, it's not really clear where, once you get beyond these really big growth areas, where more supplies are going to come from. OPEC may have it. They certainly have a lot more than they've got than they're producing now. So even if we don't reach a peak oil supply situation, even if we're not sliding down the wrong end of the curve, we're going to be in a situation where we're increasingly reliant on OPEC, and that has its own set of problems.
And how much does Iraq figure into it, both in terms of the supply of oil, but also anxieties, political anxieties surrounding the war and instability in the Middle East driving prices higher? What's the contribution of Iraq?
People have, or the market in general, I think, has kind of sequestered Iraq. Most people's base case is for chaos, but with the oil flowing. There is, a not inconsiderable possibility that next year could be the year that Iraq effectively disintegrates. But for now, our base case is that the oil will continue to flow, however unpleasant life is on the ground for your average Iraqi.
But a great deal of Iraq is potential production that's not been fully explored, right?
Oh, it certainly long-term has big growth potential, but you have to solve the security situation first. That's why next year we expect production to probably just kind of drift downwards. No one's really in there. Someone has to get in there and start drilling holes in the ground, and no one's going to be putting forward the many, many, many millions of dollars that it's going to take until there's some security.
I'm speaking with Seth Kleinman, who is a market analyst with PFC Energy based in Washington, D.C. How much exploration is the industry doing? The number of operating rigs I noticed has picked up, but it's nowhere near the peak that we saw in the early 1980s. There's talk that the industry has been keeping exploration budgets tight to please the shareholders. The Wall Street Journal had an article a few weeks ago about how there's been a real erosion of talent in the petroleum engineers are not being produced as the way they used to be. How serious a contribution is that?
It is, but the reason that they're not exploring is because most of the world has been explored. That's why people have been dismissive, or the whole peak oil debate has been complicated by the fact that people have been saying for 100 years that we're running out of oil. I don't think we're at that point yet, but at some stage over the next two decades, there's a good reason to think we will, and part of that is because when you look at what are oil companies doing with their money, they're giving it to shareholders, usually in terms of share buyback plans. They're not investing in exploration because there just aren't that many places left in the world that haven't been explored.
But when Chevron bought Unocal, I think they paid the equivalent of about $5 a barrel for their reserves. Does that suggest that the industry doesn't think that prices are going to stay in the high 60s for very long?
No, I think the industry is gradually realizing that prices, the days of 20, maybe probably even $30 oil are finished. There is a recognition of that. People don't think that 60 is sustainable, no. But replacement value of the hurdle bar for what you need to achieve in terms of returns will be lower as time goes forward.
What about the policy side of things? The Bush administration just wants to drill in Alaska. How much would that contribute to easing the supply situation?
Well, it's not going to ease the situation, but I would argue that given that this country's demand seems to grow inexorably, if you're not going to address the demand side of the situation, to me, it's fairly immoral to say, well, but we should keep our wilderness pristine, because that's synonymous with saying, well, then we should go drill holes in some other country and, you know, destroy their environment. If U.S. consumers are the people who use the oil, and there is a lot of oil in Anwar, you're talking about 1 million barrels a day. That's a very significant amount. This is not just a blip. That's a lot of oil there, and I would argue that it's morally questionable for the U.S. to not address the demand side and but still try and keep its lands pristine because they don't want to mess up their own country.
1 million barrels a day, for how long would that last?
About 10 years.
Now, the administration announced some fuel economy rules for SUVs the other day. Norm Mineta rode a Lincoln Navigator to a mobile station near LAX, which seems like all the wrong symbolism for promoting fuel economy. But what do you make of those new rules? It looks like they...
negligible.
It's negligible.
Negligible. The U.S. has to address the demand side, and the demand side will be addressed. There's two ways that'll happen. One is that oil prices will continue marching on upwards until U.S. consumers actually feel the pinch, and that probably is going to have to come via a significant recession. The other alternative is for the government to get involved. Ramping up fuel economy standards by a meaningful amount would have a huge impact. The world uses about 80 million barrels a day of oil. 10 million barrels of that almost goes into U.S. gasoline consumption. It's really, and right now, and looking forward to next year, where U.S. gasoline goes, so goes oil.
One-eighth of global oil production goes to U.S. gasoline consumption?
Yes.
That's a remarkably high number for, what, like 3-4% of the world's population?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really, and actually particularly now with the refining situation in the U.S., it is U.S. gasoline that is taking oil prices higher.
It seems that consumers have at least, as of the day before yesterday, not really changed their behavior very much. They complain to pollsters. They complain to their congresspeople about high gas prices, but they still haven't really changed their behavior very much.
July SUV sales were up 99% from the previous year.
Why is this so sticky? They think this is just a temporary thing and they can go back to driving like hogs again?
Well, if you look at gasoline as a percentage of someone's personal consumption, it's still pretty low. It gets a lot of attention, the price of gasoline, for, I'd say, two reasons. One, because when you drive around a city or the country, you see it posted everywhere, so people actually notice it. The other thing is that gasoline is one of the few things that, on a regular basis, people pay for in isolation, so you just really see it. I don't actually know how much a gallon of milk is, because when I buy milk, I tend to buy it in a trolley full of other stuff. So I may notice that groceries get more expensive, but people really notice gasoline. But I don't think that an extra 30 cents a gallon really makes a big difference to most people's lifestyles in this country.
Well, how long will we see so little in the way of economic fallout? For example, Walmart says that their sales are suffering because of high gasoline prices. They may also be just making excuses for their own individual problems, but you know, they're saying $7 a week for their average consumer, which is, when you're a Walmart customer, quite a bit of money. But we're not seeing any broad economic fallout from very high oil prices. How long is this going to go on, do you think?
That we won't see the fallout?
That we won't see the fallout.
I think it will go on until we do. Right now, again, people complain a lot about high gasoline prices, but if you don't go to Starbucks for your $4 latte, then you've pretty much saved yourself the extra expenditure that you would have spent, that you have spent on the higher price of gasoline. If gasoline gets up to 4 or 5, maybe it has to get to 6. Eventually, you will see a significant economic impact, and you'll also see people addressing their behavior on the demand side, driving more fuel-efficient vehicles, carpooling, buying more hybrids, the hybrids that actually do improve fuel economy rather than just happen to be massive and get marginally better fuel economy. I think oil prices will go up until the U.S. consumer actually does feel the pain.
And then what about the business side? Certainly it's an increasing expense for a lot of businesses. Natural gas prices, which we haven't really talked about, have been shooting higher for years and putting a pinch on a lot of businesses. Is this having any effect on business investment or hiring or the general business outlook?
The metaphor that is usually used is that higher energy costs are a headwind for the economy. And, I mean, I think we are seeing that. You were citing some statistics a few minutes ago talking about how it's not a terribly impressive economic expansion, and energy is a contributing factor to that. I don't know whether it's going to be higher energy costs that will tip the U.S. economy, but interest rates are another risk factor out there, and those are probably the two main ones right now, higher interest rates or if energy prices that just keep moving upwards. I mean, they're not making it easier for the economic expansion.
And the energy prices have remained fairly isolated. It hasn't really fed through to a broader inflation. Do you think that's going to continue?
Eventually it will. There's a significant lag, but eventually it will. But the downside, or rather counteracting that, is the deflationary impact of Chinese manufacturing. I mean, it really lowers costs across the board, so the impact of energy is less apparent.
And finally, you said several times that the only thing that could balance the situation, at least in the short to medium term, is a sharp recession in the U.S. Do you see that coming anytime in the near future?
No. I just think the economy has continued to surprise to the upside. And if the housing market really tumbles, then that could be the trigger. But I don't think that's going to happen either. If the housing market just slowly cools off, and if the economy keeps ticking along, I certainly think that oil prices will keep moving up through 2006. At some stage, this is going to become unsustainable, but I don't think it's in the immediate future.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Seth Kleinman, who is a markets analyst with PFC Energy based in Washington, D.C. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Jennifer Gordon.
Radio Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
The Salon of the Arts.
Live Mondays at 2 p.m.
With me, Janet Coleman, and you,
David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright, featuring interviews with scintillating authors.
And provocative artistes.
And why not a Poison Arts Minute?
Because that's why.
On Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, cats.
Stop clawing the furniture.
Get down.
And head for the radio.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Mondays at 2.
Hey, the cats drink coffee?
If it's brewed with fish.
And we're back here on Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and running slightly ahead of schedule. So a few comments. The fuel economy standards that the Bush administration announced the other day, it was a remarkable press event with Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta riding a Lincoln Navigator SUV, a big fat thing that is almost a poster vehicle for American excess. He rises to a mobile station near the Los Angeles airport, a part of the world that is a poster region for American excess, to announce a largely fraudulent fuel economy rules for SUVs. It used to be that the fuel economy standards were applied to a whole group of vehicles, a whole fleet for a company or a whole type of vehicle, which would force them to make more efficient vehicles and pull down the average a little bit or pull up the average miles per gallon. They're going to provide separate economy standards for different size vehicles, which will encourage the automakers to make bigger vehicles, which will encourage them to there's one, I think, a Subaru SUV that all I have to do is lengthen it by an inch or so, and it becomes a large vehicle. So it's subject to looser fuel economy standards. As the Wall Street Journal headline put it, new fuel economy rules help the biggest truck makers. So this is from the administration that brought you the Healthy Forest Initiative, which will encourage the clear cutting of trees, the Clear Skies Initiative, which will loosen up pollution restrictions on utilities, the Help America Vote Act, which generalizes the conditions, electoral conditions of Florida to the nation. And so now we have fuel economy standards that are nothing of the sort. But even if you look at their claims that they claim on face value, the amount that they propose proposed rules will save is the equivalent of about 25 days of gasoline use over the next 20 years. It's just an absolute joke, and of course it's not going to come anything close to that. So an administration that is so in love with oil, the oil industry, that it won't even make the slightest gesture, or it will make a slight gesture, but won't do anything of substance to reduce our piggish consumption of oil. So now, let's listen to Jennifer Gordon. I recorded this interview and broadcast it back in March. She is a professor of law at Fordham University. She's the founder of something called the Workplace Project, which organized immigrant workers on Long Island. And she's the author of a book called Suburban Sweatshops, published by Harvard University Press, came out earlier this year. Very fine book and a very admirable person, Jennifer Gordon. Suburban sweatshops, of course, that doesn't fit our cliché image of what suburbs are like. So what's going on out there in the Levitt towns of America?
I think what happens is you say sweatshop and people think garment factory. It's an absolute association. And if you think about what a sweatshop is and you take apart its parts, it's very bad work, very long hours, very low wages, high risk of injury. And once you see it that way, you see sweatshops all over. And suburbia is one of the places where there's the greatest growth.
And the other surprising thing is the cliched image of Long Island is a place that was populated by white flight, to put it crudely. And the population of Long Island has gotten considerably more diverse since those cliches were generated. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, in fact, Long Island has a very rich history, a rich labor history, a rich ethnic history. And so I will say Long Island has changed, and it's changed particularly with regard to its immigrant population. But it always had African Americans. It always had some amount of new immigrants. And it always had some kind of labor organizing. And all those things are an interesting part of the mix. But with regard particularly to Latino immigrants, an enormous increase in Long Island, as also in other suburbs around the United States. And I think the latest estimate is about 300,000 Latinos living in Long Island. And what you see, if you look at immigration patterns over the past 20 years, is that they've shifted dramatically. Immigrants are not anymore going in the largest numbers to the big immigrant-receiving cities. Instead of Los Angeles, they're going to the suburbs around Los Angeles. Instead of New York, they're going to the suburbs around New York. Or they're going to the south and southeastern states. So you see things like in Atlanta, 817% increase in its foreign-born population between 1980 and 2000, a real shift in demographics around the country.
And in many places, this has provoked a nativist backlash, and Long Island was in the news for that. What's happened to that?
Well, starting in the late 1990s, many of the people listening will be familiar with the story of how two immigrant laborers on a day labor corner were attacked, and actually there was attempted murder of them by two men, skinheads, who were later convicted for trying to kill them. And sadly, that wasn't the end of the matter. A surge of racist anti-immigrant sentiment led by a group with ties to national xenophobic immigrant-hating groups. There have been firebombings, anti-immigrant demonstrations, really a terrible situation.
Employers have frequently brought in immigrants to lower wages, so there is this material basis for what turns out to be rather ugly racist displays. How can you think about these things? How do you balance this sense of looking at immigrant workers as threatening a standard of living against cosmopolitanism and decency and tolerance?
Well, I think the first thing to realize when you're thinking about that question is if you don't fight with immigrants for basic workplace rights for them, you're ceding the ground, right? Like the fight to defend immigrants' basic rights, the right to minimum wage, the right to decent treatment on the job, is, first of all, by me, it's a fight for human decency and dignity, and you support it because of that. But it's also a fight to create a floor in terms of wages. And if you don't stand with immigrants for those basic rights, you end up with no floor at all on how people can be treated.
And let's talk more specifically about the kinds of workers you're working with and your workplace project. First of all, what industries, what sectors are these suburban sweatshops that you are working with?
Really in service work. So what you see are restaurants, small restaurants, the busboys and the dishwashers, working 70, 75 hours a week, getting $2.50, $3 an hour. Landscapers. Landscapers don't get promised less than minimum wage. Almost universally, they're promised more than minimum wage. their problems are twofold. They don't get paid. That is, they'll go through a month or 6 weeks of work, and their employer will say, "Oops, sorry, the money didn't come in. You're not going to get paid for that work." Or sometimes, and they get badly injured on the job. And that's sort of hard. You know, you think of landscaping as your kid mows the lawn, right? Or your kid mows the lawn for a summer and gets paid. But if you think of landscaping or lawn mowing as a sweatshop industry, what that means is these guys are mowing 40, 50, 60 lawns a day. So like in any sweatshop, speed is of the essence. And so employers will remove guards from lawnmowers. And if there's a clog, they'll tell the worker to keep the machine running while they free it. And so what you see among men who have a long history of landscaping is they're missing digits of their fingers because their fingers get cut off when the blades start to spin and the clog is freed. That plus back injuries and unsafe chemicals, those are the kind of hazards in landscaping. You see a lot of domestic workers at the very low end of the market who are paid $200 for a week of work, maybe 80 hours in that week. So a lot of service industries. Also at the low end, janitorial work, construction work at the low end, the whole range of service work.
So how do you approach organizing a population that's so diverse, so spread out, that is in many senses socially or even physically invisible to the outside world? What's the approach?
One approach is a worker center approach, and I think I'll talk about that in a second, but I think the challenges you mentioned are one reason why unions have really struggled with these lowest wage workers, workers in the underground economy, or, you know, or sort of the half under and half above ground economy.
Yeah, this is the very opposite of like Ford Rouge plant, which is, you know, continental in scale.
Right, exactly. It's not out there, although actually I think it's frankly very visible if you want to look for it. But it's not one big location. It's small numbers of workers scattered all over the place. And that is a real challenge for the standard union organizing model. Add to that that a number of these workers are undocumented. Add to that their vulnerability and their urgent need for work, and you have a nightmare for the standard union organizing model. So worker centers, as I mentioned, are a fairly new phenomenon, which are an attempt to work with immigrants themselves as leaders, to take on some of the worst working conditions in the underground economy. And one of their features is they often work across industries because you don't have, in Long Island, it would be very rare to have, say, an immigrant man who said, "I am a landscape worker. I have always worked in landscape." Instead, you do a few months in landscape. The season ends. You go into a restaurant. You may have a part-time janitor job to complement that. Then you lose those jobs and you're in a factory for a while. Working across industry allows the workers to stay with the organization even as they change jobs. Another feature of worker centers is they offer services, and think of services as a bridge to organizing. So the Workplace Project, when I was there, had a legal clinic that helped immigrant workers solve their unpaid wages problems, and it now continues to do that in a sort of workshop way where immigrant workers support each other. Worker centers do a lot of education, popular education.
A lot of immigrant workers think of them here themselves as just here temporarily. They pick up some money before they go home. Their hearts may be with their family and friends at home. How do you deal with that?
I think that you're absolutely right that most people come with the idea that they're going to be here a short time and return home. And I think there's a turning point when people realize they thought it was going to be 2 years, and it's been three, it's been four, it's been seven, it's been 15. And they're not going home, and they haven't been able to earn the money that in their fantasies they could have. And I think groups like worker centers play an important role in getting people to stop and think. You know, you may not be here forever, but while you're here, how are you being treated? Does that comport with your sense of who you are as a human being and your dignity? And is it worth it to take some time and take some risks to stand up for your rights?
I'm speaking with Jennifer Gordon, author of Suburban Sweatshops, just out from Harvard University Press. How did someone find her way from the Harvard Law School to organizing immigrant workers on Long Island?
Harvard Law School was actually a detour, I think. I had been working with Central American immigrants before I went to law school, right around the time that employer sanctions were passed. So all of a sudden, for the first time in our country's history, it became illegal for an employer to hire an undocumented worker. And it was the work that I did both with workers and with employers at that time, educating the employers about how they could keep immigration out of their workplaces, educating the workers about how to defend themselves if there was an immigration raid, that the idea of starting a center for immigrant workers who were largely outside unions, who were being ignored by government enforcement, that I started to think about that. And then I went to law school, and it was when I was in my second year of law school that I started to raise money to start the Workplace Project. So law school has been hugely helpful, but it came in the middle of a flow of work in that area.
Let's step out of the main topic here just to ask a broader policy question. There seems to be a contradiction at the heart of our attitude and policy towards immigrants. The economy, in some sense, would grind to a halt without them. Businesses want low-wage workers. Rich people want nannies and gardeners. At the same time, there's this attempt to police the borders and punish people who violate immigration laws. What is the sense behind all that, or is it as contradictory as it looks in the face?
Well, I actually think it's quite a coherent system. It's just it would sound so ugly if the President of the United States were to stand up and say what that system is. You know, the system is there are only so many people politically that we can let in legally to the United States without generating a backlash. And yet we acknowledge that we need their work. So we're going to make it very difficult to come, but not impossible, and not really enforce minimum wage laws and other protective laws so that we do create, while we condemn this vulnerable low-wage workforce, and yet we keep the barriers high to really becoming a full citizen in the United States. It's ugly. It has a certain coherence, nonetheless.
So it makes sense from the boss's point of view to have this scared population, uncertain status, who will do anything to go along?
Oh, yes. And, you know, in fact, it's the Wall Street Journal that's been the strongest advocate for open borders. Of all of the major newspapers, they regularly, around July 4th, published their open borders editorial. They took a brief hiatus after 9/11, but they've republished it since. And massive undocumented immigration serves business interests, a number of business interests, although not all of them.
Let's talk about the Workplace Project itself. How did it get started? What was the strategy? And what's happening with it now?
I started the Workplace Project in 92. Actually, all I started doing with the help of CORESAN, a Central American Refugee Center in Hempstead, was offering help to immigrant workers who hadn't been paid minimum wage or who hadn't been paid anything at all, frankly. And out of that and some classes that I started giving about labor history and labor rights and immigration in the United States, came a group of immigrant workers who were committed to founding an independent worker center. The first organizer who worked with me, a Salvadoran man named Omar Enriquez, he and I and this group of workers, a couple years after I had started this clinic, founded the Workplace Project as an independent member-based worker center, really with two levels of organizing strategy. One is, of course, what you think of when you say organizing, which is how you take on bad wages and bad working conditions. The other, though, and just as important, is the strategy for building a genuine immigrant-led organization. And so a lot of thought at the Workplace Project has gone into how you bring immigrant workers in, invite them into the organization, how you build their capacity to lead in the organization and organizing efforts, building a board that comes entirely out of the membership, and so on. And so I was at the Workplace Project for 6 years. I left in 98. It's been run pretty much since then by Nadia Marin Molina, who's the current director, who's done an amazing job in the face of, as we were discussing, the real surge in anti-immigrant sentiment on Long Island, yes, in late 90s and early in this decade.
So tell us some stories of the workers you started trying to organize. For example, like day laborers standing on a street corner. What's the approach to organizing them? What are the issues? What's the strategy? What's the sales pitch?
Well, the first thing that happened with day laborers, and this was in 1994, was that a group of day laborers who we were working with, which is in what really is the most common organizing approach to day laborers, just to defend their right to ask for work, to work out a place that they and the city and contractors could all agree they could stand. This was in Inwood. Those workers started to talk about setting a minimum wage for that street corner where they were waiting. People were going for around $45 a day, and they wanted $60. And then people started talking, and they said, well, look, if we set it at $60, they'll just go up the road to the Franklin Square workers' day labor corner, or to Freeport, or to Westbury, or, you know, any of the other ones in Nassau County. And that's when we realized you can't do it just on one corner. You have to have committees on all the corners. And so Omar went around to all the corners, invited the workers to a big meeting. Each corner that I've mentioned formed its own committee. They all got together. They all decided on $60 a day. They all went back to their corners and then began the hard work, really, for 3 years of making that minimum wage, set by nobody but the workers, right? Certainly not set by the government, making that real. And that is the most brute kind of organizing. You know, you're on a corner. There are 100 guys on the corner. They know on a good day only 30 of them will get jobs. A truck rolls up. The truck says $55, and 100 men who need work have to say, no, I won't go. No union structure, you know, no beautiful hiring hall, no strike wages, nothing. They just have to watch that truck pull away. And for a while, the Workplace Project and those workers' committees were able to enforce that minimum wage. And that was extraordinary to see, you know, literally to see workers watch a truck pull away because they would not break their own minimum wage.
You said for a while, did it fall apart?
It fell apart in small ways and then eventually entirely. In small ways in the sense that as every morning goes on and then as every season, you know, as the good weather period goes on, you know, later in the day, jobs are scarcer. People will go for less. Later in the season, fall is coming. People will go for less. That the committees were able to live with. But come 96, with a real surge nationally in anti-immigrant sentiment, with a crackdown on immigrants, the workers were just too anxious to hold to that minimum wage. People wanted to earn whatever money they could. And the Workplace Project, as a democratic organization, respected that and decided that it was, you know, it was going to continue to work with day laborers, but not itself certainly enforce any kind of minimum wage that the workers themselves didn't want. At the same time, the economy had gotten a little better, you know, and the $60 no longer seemed like such a stretch, you know, and that as a minimum certainly holds on most street corners now.
What about domestics? How do you go about organizing them?
Domestic workers in the United States have a long history of trying to organize. African-American women, particularly a little after the turn of the century, again in the 70s, have tried to organize and sometimes for a time succeeded. But it's the hardest group of workers to organize because you have one worker and one employer in every workplace, right? You know, the basic concept of organizing is that there's power in numbers. There are no numbers, you know, unless you're living in upstairs, downstairs. There are no numbers if you are the domestic worker for one family. And so the challenge is to figure out what kind of leverage you can have. One sort of leverage is going for people who want to do right by their workers and setting some standards that they can adhere to. And the Workplace Project did some of that. But another one is working with agencies, placement agencies, because that's where employers in numbers meet with workers in numbers. And the Workplace Project carried out a campaign, another version of which was later carried out by Domestic Workers United in New York City, to set basic rights for domestic workers and to pressure agencies, you know, through protests and the media and phone calls and so on, to adhere to those minimum rights. And so the Workplace Project got a group of agencies in Long Island to agree to its Domestic Worker Bill of Rights. Later, Domestic Workers United in New York City got the city council to pass a bill requiring a basic contract for domestic workers when they were placed through agencies.
What are the possibilities for some kind of hiring hall arrangement or temp firms or worker co-ops, some way to formalize these presently informal relationships?
The Workplace Project has started two cooperatively owned businesses. One, CLIP, the Cooperative Landscaping Innovation Project, its business card said, a revolution in landscaping. It started in the late 90s and is now an independent business. And it still runs the Unity Cooperative, which is a women's cooperative that does home and business cleaning. And so, you know, on a very small scale, the organization has done cooperatively owned businesses and experimented with them. Those are fairly rare in the United States, although they're much more common in other countries. hiring halls are a real challenge in the sense that there's some things that work well about a day labor street corner. You know, precarious as it is, it gets workers where they're needed, and it gets homeowners a place, gives homeowners a place to hire workers, and contractors a place, and workers who otherwise wouldn't have access to work a place where they can get jobs. And the difficulty is, if you formalize a street corner too much, set up a really rigid hiring hall with a lottery system or rules, what you find is you have another day labor street corner at the 7-Eleven around the corner where people are avoiding the formal one and recreating something informal. And so the real challenge, I think, with day labor organizing is to make it work for everybody who benefits from it while removing its abusive side.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Gordon, author of Suburban Sweatshops, just out from Harvard University Press. What about the role of law and lawyers in all this? Sometimes it runs the risk, I would imagine, of devolving into a legalistic, litigation-oriented approach rather than organizing people. How do you deal with the poles of that spectrum?
There's certainly a tension in the sense that if what you're doing, you're offering legal support to people to help them resolve, unpaid wages problems or minimum wage problems, that in itself is not going to lead to organizing. Just because people come in because they've had that problem doesn't mean they're going to stay to organize. And if a lawyer can solve their problem, then the question of why they should organize, much higher risk, much longer term, much more uncertain payoff, is a real question. Of course, a lawyer can't solve their problem, and that's, in a sense, how the tension gets resolved. A lawyer may be able to get, in fact, in my experience, almost always is able to get a victory in court, but a lawyer can't get that victory enforced. The Workplace Project has found that really the only enforcement tool available to workers is protesting, literally putting up a picket outside an employer's home where you parade the judgment around until the employer agrees.
Not a common suburban site, right?
No, not at all. Not your typical suburban scene. But the trick or the challenge for the Workplace Project has been to figure out how talking to people about their rights can be something that is a first stage in an organizing process instead of something that shuts people down with a feeling like, well, those may be my rights, but there's no way I'm going to be able to get them. And simultaneously, how working either with a lawyer or with another group of workers to get legal rights respected can become the first step in an organizing process rather than a sort of dead end where people throw up their hands in desperation.
What were the relations like between the Workers' Center, the Workplace Project, and the unions?
Varied tremendously by the union. In a number of instances, the Workplace Project carried out joint campaigns with unions, or really, I should say, worked with a union as its kind of immigrant connection arm, so that the immigrants would come to the Workplace Project for meetings, but the meetings were about organizing into a particular union. Did that a couple times with CWA and once or twice with the United Food and Commercial Workers. Efforts to use what the Workplace Project had in terms of relationships with the community to build a bridge to union organizing. Other times when workers came in with unions that were corrupt or not responsive to them, there was more conflict between the project and unions, and the project would end up supporting workers who wanted to run different candidates for shop stewards, say, or organize, help those workers organize for a more responsive and more respectful union in their workplace.
And you say that this really can't be a model in the sense that it's so rooted in particular circumstances, but are there lessons to be learned for reversing the sad decline of American unionism here?
I think that worker centers are not themselves, not only are they not a model, but they're not themselves going to solve the problem of sweatshops. But I do think they have important things to offer to unions. One is the lesson that there's no such thing as an unorganizable worker. And worker centers, as well as the Workplace Project, are really developing immigrant worker leadership among people who our inclination might be to write off as unorganizable. Another lesson is that you can win victories in situations that look desperate. Tremendously moving and important victory just a few days ago, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a worker center in Immokalee, Florida, after a three-year campaign, got Taco Bell to agree to increase what it pays for tomatoes, 1 cent a pound, and have that amount pass through directly to the workers, which, given how much tomatoes workers pick in a day will mean a real wage increase. And also, Taco Bell agreed to put pressure on others in the industry to raise their standards. That was a long and hard-fought campaign, and the result is something that will directly increase workers' wages. I think the techniques that worker centers are using and their commitment to building a base in the immigrant community are showing that you can win what look like unwinnable battles, and the commitment to both that base building and taking the time it takes to figure out where you can win those kind of victories, I think, are hugely important lessons.
And that was the voice of Jennifer Gordon, who is a professor of law at Fordham University, creator of the Workplace Project, a worker center in Long Island. She founded it in 1992, and author of the book Suburban Sweatshops, which was published earlier this year by Harvard University Press. That interview was first broadcast on this show in March, March 17th, I believe. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. And let's go out with this fairly recent release from a British hip hopper called Lady Sovereign, her 9 to 5.
Let me be.